Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In December 1933, in the depths of the Great Depression, a man with the pseudonym B. Verdot placed an ad in the local newspaper in Canton, Ohio, offering to help individuals and families hard hit. "Write me," he said. Their letters and stories poured in, and back came checks, small but crucial in those hard times. Investigative reporter Ted Gupp tells the story. The secret giver was his grandfather. This hour on Point, a remarkable story of hard times and giving. Plus, we'll get an update on billionaires and philanthropy in the hard times today. Joining me right now in the studio is Ted Gupp. He's now chair of the journalism department at Emerson College. He was a longtime investigative reporter for The Washington Post, for Time Magazine. His new book is A Secret Gift: How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. Ted Gupp, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So here you are, investigating what turns out to be your own family's history. How did you come on to this story? There was a suitcase full of letters that ended up in your lap.
My mother took me to her attic in Kennebunk, Maine, said, "I have something for you." She handed me this battered old black suitcase. She didn't know what was in it. Mm-hmm. She said, "Some old papers. You're welcome to it." And a few days later, I opened it up, and inside I found hundreds of letters, all of them dated December 1933, a stack of 150 canceled checks, a bank passbook, and ultimately a front page story in my hometown newspaper describing this gift.
The Canton, Ohio Repository was that newspaper. And talk about catnip for an investigative reporter. In you plunged. And it takes us back to what is your hometown, where your family has been for at least a couple generations here, Canton, Ohio, and a story that comes back to your grandfather. Now, before we get to that, paint a picture of Canton, Ohio. If we go back to 1933 or 1930, you name it, you say that this, I mean, there had been a powerful sort of manufacturing economy or powerful economy before the Depression. But in 1933, you write, it was a landscape that Charles Dickens would have recognized. What did you find as you looked back?
Well, it was part Dickens and part Dante, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. If you went back in 33 in my hometown, you would have seen a town that had unemployment approaching 50%, not 1.5, but 5.0.
We think it's bad at 9.6.
Right. You would have seen children in patched coats stooped over the B&O railroad track, picking up, scavenging little pieces of coal that had fallen from passing trains and putting them in burlap bags to heat their homes that night. A lot of the kids did not know the word breakfast because there was nothing to eat before they went to school.
I remember a story from my grandfather not far off in Illinois of a young friend of his who lost his legs picking up coal, and the train came right over those legs, remembering watching his father carry his son's legs home in a bucket.
Oh, my.
That's the kind of picture you draw of Canton, Ohio in 1933.
It is.
So here we are, Canton, Ohio, which has its own issues today, and we'll talk about that. We're in northeast Ohio, south of Cleveland. This is 100 miles west of Pittsburgh, something like that. And here's this ad that runs in the Canton, Ohio repository. This is December 1st, 1933. Give us a little background here, because, you know, the language is kind of obtuse. It clearly really called out to people, but the headline on an ad that's sort of the size of a playing card, you write, on page 3, so pretty prominent, has this headline, paid for, written in the ad, "In consideration of the white-collar man!" Exclamation mark. I'm going to ask you to read this for us, but tell us, is there something we should know?
Well, the language of the ad is a little arched. It's a little starchy.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather never got past the second grade,
mm-hmm.
and I think he overcompensated for that by speaking the way that he thought people with formal education spoke.
Okay.
And I think this offer that he made reflects that. read this ad then. It's a letter from a B. Verdot. It's in the December 1st issue of the Canton, Ohio Repository.
In consideration of the white-collar man, suppose if I were confronted with an economic situation where the bread of tomorrow is the problem of today, there is a question in my mind if I would accept charity directly offered by welfare organizations. I know there are hundreds of men that are confronted with economic problems and think, feel, and act the same way. To men or families in such position, the maker of this offer, who will remain unknown until the very end, will be glad if he is given an opportunity to help from 50 to 75 such families, so they will be able to spend a merry and joyful Christmas. To such men or families that will request such financial aid, the writer pledges that their identity will never be revealed. Please write B. Verdot, General Delivery, Canton, Ohio. In writing, please familiarize me with your true circumstances, and financial aid will be promptly sent.
And the people of Canton, Ohio, read that letter on page 3, December 1st, 1933, and boy, did they respond. The letters were in the suitcase that your mother handed you from that attic all those years later. What kind of thing did you read in those letters?
It was stark, and it was unnerving, because this was my hometown. This was the landscape that I grew up in. The street names were familiar, the family names were familiar, but the landscape was utterly unfamiliar because of the desperation. This offer reached the entire town. It was so electrifying that they wrote a news story about it on the front page, and word of it spread for hundreds of miles.
And the letters came in. Howard Summers talked about how he and his wife were earning money by picking wild dandelions and selling them door to door. I mean, letter after letter talks about our clothes are worn out, our shoes are worn out, we cannot feed the children, somebody's got tuberculosis, jobs are gone. The desperation was just stark in these letters.
Yeah, we talk about the difficult times today, but there's a distinction to be drawn between the difficult times and the hard times that are capitalized and refer to that decade of the Great Depression. Most Americans today who did not pass through that period really have no concept of the depths to which many American citizens had to reconcile themselves year after year after year.
We're going to learn your grandfather's story. It was very interesting in itself. But the thing that mattered most in that month of December 1933 was that stack of canceled checks that he sent back out. They were not enormous checks. But judging from the letters that he got once again in return, it meant a lot to people. These are like $5 checks. What did that mean?
Well, $5 was more like $80 to $100. The minimum wage.
In today's money.
In today's money. And the minimum wage then was 33 cents. But most people were delighted if they could earn a dollar in a day. $5 was more than most of these folks had seen in memory. It meant for them that they would have a Christmas, that there would be a Christmas dinner. One family, the Margot family, it meant that of the five children, three of whom were placed in an orphanage, they could get those three children back and allow them to spend Christmas with them and have a dinner and have presents for them.
And so there was some joy there. It wasn't only the poor who had been hit by this point in the Depression in Canton, Ohio. I've got a letter here from George Monnet, had been one of Canton's most successful businessmen, owned a Ford dealership, employed an 11-person band at one point. By 1933, he was struggling to feed his family. Here's his letter, courtesy of WKSU in Kent, Ohio, his grandson, Tom Haas, reading from the original.
Dear sir, your interesting and benevolent article appearing in the Canton Repository prompted me to write and advise how the Depression left the writer. For 26 years, I was in the automobile business, prosperous at one time, and have done more than my share of giving at Christmas at all times. I have a family of six, and struggle is the word for me now for a living. Christmas will not mean much to our family this year, as my business, bank, real estate, insurance policies are all swept away. Our resources are nil at present. Perhaps my situation is no different than hundreds of others. However, a man who knows what it is to be up and down can fully appreciate the spirit one has gone through the same ordeal. You are to be congratulated for your benevolence and kind offer to those who have experienced this trouble, and such as the writer is going through now. No doubt you will have a happy Christmas, as there is more real happiness in giving and making someone else happy than receiving. May I extend to you a very happy Christmas. Sincerely, George W. Monnet.
It was those who had been well off and certainly those who had not, right across the board at this point.
Right. This gentleman, George Monnet, had helped start a country club. He had a small yacht, a summer home. By 29, he had nothing. By 33, when he wrote this letter, he had less than nothing.
We're going to come back and hear more of the letters that poured in 1933. Imagine what those letters might sound like today. Ted Gupp is with us. His new book is A Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. There's stormy weather behind us right now. Ethel Waters in 1933.
When he went away, the blues walked in and met me. If he stays away, old rocking chair will get me. All I do is pray the Lord above will let me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Once more can go on. All I have in life is gone. Stormy weather. Since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're going to hear in just a couple of minutes, incredibly, from one of the people who wrote one of those letters in 1933. She will be with us, Helen Palm, in just a moment. Ted Gupp is with me in the studio. Before we go to Helen, give us a taste of another letter, the kind of need, the kind of desperation that came into your grandfather, Ted.
This is a letter from Edith May. It was written December 18th, 1933. And she was 39 at the time. And she wrote, Mr. Beaverdot. And she lived on a farm just outside of Canton, so she wasn't sure she qualified for his gift. She wrote, Mr. Beaverdot, maybe I shouldn't write to you, not living right in Canton, but for some time I have been wanting to know somebody who could give me some help. We have known better days. 4 years ago, we were getting $135 a month for milk. Now Saturday, we got 12. This 12 has to go as follows. Pay for the gas to haul the milk. Get chopping. Pay for coal. During the cold spell, buy an axe to make wood. Buy a tire for a dollar. And I had $2 to buy groceries. Imagine, 5 of us for a month. If I only had $5, I would think I am in heaven. I would buy a pair of shoes for my oldest boy in school. His toes are all out, and no way to give him a pair. He was just 6 in October. Then I have a little girl, will be 4 2 days before Christmas, and a boy of 18 months. I could give them all something for Christmas, and I would be very happy. And let me read how this letter closes, and then give you a footnote on this. And oh my, I know what it is to be hungry and cold. We suffered so last winter, and this one is worse. Please do help me. My husband don't know I am writing. And I haven't even a stamp. But I am going to beg the mailman to post this for me. And the letter arrived without a stamp. And the 4-year-old that he referred to, her birthday was 2 days before Christmas. Her name's Felice. And she remembers that particular birthday. Unlike all others, it was the first time she went into town, saw the Christmas lights. Her mother took her to a 5 and dime and there bought her a little toy pony. A wooden pony on wheels.
And you know this, Ted, because you tracked down the families who had been recipients of your grandfather's anonymous largesse.
And I talked to Felice, and it was the only toy of her childhood, and it was her favorite object. And you flash forward today, and she raises miniature ponies. And she, while we were talking, she said to me, I always wondered how that one Christmas
we could afford to go into town and get me a present. And then we both at the same moment arrived at the same realization that it was my grandfather's gift that allowed her to do that.
Your presumption in going back to track down, follow up these letters, track down the families, get their stories of that era, was that the writers of these letters would have passed on. One of them had not. We're going to hear in just a moment from Helen Palm. Introduce us, if you would. How did you find Helen Palm?
Well, Helen Palm, she was the one letter writer for whom I could not find a descendant. So I turned the book in. It was edited. I'd given up. Mm-hmm. Then I had a couple extra hours one day after the book was turned in, and I made a last effort. In journalism, we say God rewards those who make a call after the last call.
Yes.
And I was interviewing her daughter, Janet. I finally found a descendant. I was asking her when her mother was born, where she grew up. I was about to ask when she passed away, and she interrupted me and said, "Would you like to speak with her?" And I nearly fell off my chair.
How old was Helen Palm when she wrote a letter to your grandfather in 1933?
14 years old. Yeah.
Helen Palm is now 90 years old. She joins us right now from Massillon, Ohio, the sole surviving recipient of one of the gifts of B. Verdot, that is Samuel J. Stone, the grandfather of Ted Gupp. Ms. Palm, Helen Palm, thank you so very much for joining us. Hello, Helen, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Helen, thank you very much. It's so great that you're still around to share these stories with us.
Oh, I feel real good.
I'm sure you do. Do you have the letter that you wrote in 1933? Could you read it for us, Helen?
Yeah, I could read it for you.
Please do.
Okay. It says, "Dear sir, when we went over to the neighbors to borrow the paper, I read your article, and I am 14. I'm writing this because I need clothing, and sometimes we run out of food. My father does not want us to ask for charity, but us children would like to have clothing for Christmas. When he had a job, us children used to have nice things. I also have brothers and sisters. If you send me $10, I would buy clothing and buy the Christmas dinner and supper. Thank you."
Signed, Helen Palm. And do you remember, Helen, when that check came in the mail and what it meant to you and your family?
Well, we got $5 instead of 10 because there were so many people that wrote. And I sure do remember, though.
What did you do with that $5 in 1933?
I took Mom and Dad down to the State Theater, and we saw the show down there in West Tuscan Canton. And then I took them out for ice cream, and a little bit of money that we had, got some candy with it, and I bought a pair of black patent leather shoes.
Ted Gupp, say hi to Helen Palm.
Helen, how are you?
Is this Ted?
It is, Helen. How are you?
Well, your voice sounds real good. I'm feeling real good after that big doings you gave us.
Well, you defined the evening. I will tell you, you were the star.
You've just been out in Ohio talking with people whose families had been part of this circle of giving and receiving.
I brought together the descendants in the Palace Theater, and
uh-huh.
Some of them read from the letters, but only one of the letter writers still survives,
and that is
Helen. And Helen, I am so happy that you're on.
Ted, you write that back at that time, before that new pair of shoes, Helen, like others, would cut out the shape of the sole of her shoe from an empty shredded wheat box and put
yeah,
it into those.
That.
Well, there's the testimony firsthand. What, because your shoes were wearing out in the bottom and you needed something between you and the stones?
That's right. I did that all the time with the shredded wheat box.
It's just incredible. Just incredible. And do you remember how it felt to have this charity from an anonymous, giver way back then, Helen?
Well, I just thought he was a wonderful man, whoever it was, and I would have liked to meet him.
Is it a story that you told your children as you were growing up? Did it stay with you?
I never mentioned about it.
It's just one of those things.
They were growing up. My mom and dad knew, you know, and my sister and brother, but they're both gone.
And did you, once it came out that maybe, I don't know how you ever learned, maybe from Ted Gupp, that it was Samuel J. Stone, Sam Stone, who had a clothing store there in Canton. Did you know him? Had you ever been in his store?
I used to go in there, because I had a paper route and I earned a little bit of money. I used to go in there and buy my dad socks and ties and hankies and things like that I could afford. But I used to get them for every occasion that he was, like, Father's Day or birthdays or something like that. I used to always get him something. And I'd go in that store, and boy, I never realized I didn't know the people that owned it.
Helen Palm was 14 in 1933.
I really loved his, Mr. Stone's daughter.
My mother.
That would be your mother, Tim.
Thank you, Helen.
That's just terrific. Helen, it's remarkable that we can have you read this letter for us today. Speaking of sounding great, you sound absolutely terrific, and we wish you just a terrific holiday season. We're really grateful to you for joining us and reading that for us today.
Thank you, Helen.
Helen Palm in Massillon, Ohio. Thank you so much, Ms. Palm.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for being with us. It meant something to Helen Palm and her family, a pair of shoes, an ice cream, a movie in really tough times. It meant something for the whole town, Ted. You found that it resonated right through, not just the direct recipients of those little checks.
Right. I think it sent a message to the town that someone cared. This was really before the New Deal had begun to be implemented. People were feeling isolated and abandoned. And I would argue that this gift actually probably saved some lives. There was a gentleman named Mr. White, J.L. White. He was one of the people that wrote my grandfather. And he said that if he had known at the time, he would never have put his life savings in the bank because the bank failed. And then he wrote, "Your encouraging letter and generous offer in repository of December 18 has again given me the courage to try. Yesterday evening, just before I read your letter, was thinking of things that no person should. 4 years ago, I was a successful businessman. I am down flat. But since reading your letter, we'll say that I am not out yet." And there were many that referred obliquely to thoughts of suicide and drew significant courage from this offer.
An entire community from the generosity of one man. We're going to hear the story of that man. It is quite a story in itself. Ted Gupp is with us. His new book is A Secret Gift. Ted, there are a lot of callers who are responding to this story. Let me get one right now from New Orleans in Louisiana. Liz, thank you so much for calling. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for letting me talk.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that my experience down here is post-Katrina, after Katrina, and since the oil disaster, I seem to see people donate a lot more to different causes and give up their time and their Saturdays and Sundays and contribute to local events. I'm not being Pollyannish about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the effect of the economy has hit us here, too, despite the other, you know, benefits and sometimes we get with support. But I've just seen people, because it means so much more and they know the impact to them personally, that I just seem to see people do a lot more, and so that was the point I wanted to make. It's really real to people when they're in the midst of a disaster.
And who's stepping up, Liz? Who do you see stepping up most generously in that environment?
I think it's across the board. I really do. When we have our neighborhood association or any of those nonprofits, you just see everybody, and you see people you haven't seen in a while who are out there giving time. If they're not giving money, they're giving time. I know our local radio stations, our local NPR station, finds it easier to raise money than they did in the past because people are so much more connected and really feel this, you know, it's not abstract. Besides which, we had all these great people who came down here and donated time in their, you know, their summer, school kids who came down and gave up their summers to help with the building, and it also kind of inspired me to give up more of my time. I know I reach in my pocket more. I give a larger percentage of my salary to local issues.
Katrina pulled it out, sort of revved it up there in New Orleans for your own community and for people from right across this country who came down to help. Liz, I'm so glad for your call. Ted, help us understand your grandfather and something about his background, because there were other revelations here and the source of his motivation.
I had thought that he gave this gift because he'd had a tough upbringing. He'd worked in coal mines. He'd washed soda bottles with acid that ate at his fingertips. He'd been duped into being a strike breaker and was bloodied. So he had a tough time, and I figured he just identified with the people writing to him. But there was more to it. I had his birth certificate from Pittsburgh and passports confirming it. But when I started delving into it, What I discovered is they were all fraudulent, that in fact he entered the country at age 15 in 1902. He was a refugee from Romanian pogroms, and this secret Santa that everyone assumed was a good Christian in Canton was born an Orthodox Jew who kept kosher and spoke Yiddish.
From Romania. An illegal immigrant.
Well, certainly he committed fraud and forgery in creating these documents to assert that he was a citizen.
Unbelievable. So there he is. He had gotten into the clothing business and had some success, though he knew ups and downs in his life. But you've given some thought to what it was who brought this Romanian Jewish immigrant to the United States, living a little bit of a lie in his presentation of having been born in Pittsburgh, to reach in his pocket and do this thing for those around him anonymously, and with a very, we heard it in his letter, with a very kind of Christmas appeal to it in 1933. What about his motivation?
Well, I think he was part of a group called the Fuzgars that walked out of Romania with rags on their backs. They were rejected by every country until he finally came to America. I think this gift, to some degree, was an expression of profound appreciation for his adopted land, for a country that took him in and made him feel that he was both secure and at home. And I think it was also a reaching out to people who were enduring precisely what he had endured.
And he'd become a part of this culture in Kent. I mean, he may have been raised an Orthodox Jew, but by 1933 there was a Christmas tree in his house. He was not observant in that way. He was looking to be part of this community and became so.
And he was very playful. At Christmas time, though he had three young daughters, he always insisted on opening his presents first.
Oh, my gosh, it's a great story. What do you come to think about this yourself? You know, what do you take from this story of your grandfather's generosity?
Well, I think it's a story about my grandfather, but I think it's also a story about American identity. I think it's about who we are as a people, and it shows the power of the small. You know, at a time of bailouts and tarps and such, and we talked billions of dollars, here was $5 that literally elevated an entire community. And I think it doesn't mean that we don't need the large support, but I think it shows the potency of individual help and of the power of connectedness of people reaching out and helping each other.
Ted Gupp is with us. His new book is Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression, how little $5 checks, lots of them, maybe $80 or $100 equivalent today, made such a difference in the lives of people who were really up against it in 1933, December of 1933. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
If you should go back to your nowhere, leaving me with a memory, I'll always wait for your return out of nowhere, hoping you'll bring your love to me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Got lots of great stories coming in here, Ted, from listeners. Here's Donna, who says, listening to the program today about the spirit of giving reminds me of one of our family stories. My grandparents, living along the New Jersey coast, had my father, her father, who was a child at the time, go fishing every day and bring the fish home to add to the daily meal. People lined up for it. My family, she says, had these resources, and it shared them. Here's L. Armand says, this program reminds me of my grandfather, also from Ohio, Akron, Cuyahoga Falls, and his Sunday dinner table frequently had people who were alone, no family to go home to after Mass. He says, I can remember four who were there regularly. Grandfather always fed people, gave them a place to curl up to keep warm. Rich in Brookline, Massachusetts. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to stress the idea of brotherhood at this time of year and all through the year, and being that Mr. Stone was Jewish, whether he was religious or not, there is a strong vein of social justice that runs through the feelings of Jews, and of course he directed his messages towards the Christians and Christmas in the Canton, but I just wanted to stress that This was a time that there was a lot of vitriolic radio preachers like Father Coughlin,
yes,
who said horrible things about Jews. And I also wonder whether the fellow who owned the country club would have allowed Mr. Stone into his country club if he were Jewish. But I want to stress that, in summary, that Jews help Christians, Christians help Jews, Muslims help different people, and we should all recognize that everybody is everyone's brother and should take care of everybody else.
Rich, I so appreciate your call. I'm really glad for it. Thank you. Ted Gupp.
Well, I think that that's an excellent point. You know, 33 was also when Hitler came to power, and I think my grandfather, given what he experienced, would have appreciated the security all the more. 7 years later, in 1940, when the Germans were bombing the Brits in London, my grandfather anonymously sent wool coats to British citizens, and in the pocket of each coat, he wrote a little essay about the meaning of democracy to him. So I don't think that he saw people in terms of Christians and Jews. I think he really did view it as the family of man.
And at a time of real need where the social justice message of, as Rich says, many faiths, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, thank heavens when it comes to the fore. Rich, thanks for your call. Peggy in Mount Vernon, Kentucky. Peggy, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. And, yes, ask me a question.
Well, what do you make of this story, Peggy? How do you respond to it?
I respond to it with a great deal of very quiet joy, because it is so easy to get extremely depressed with the stories and the comments that people make that lead me to believe this kind of giving is not as prevalent as it could be or should be. I've noted that the people in certain political groups are fans of Ayn Rand, whom I read when I was in college in the 50s, and I was disturbed by her then, and I'm even disturbed more by the message today.
The kind of you are on your own
message. We are on our own, and tough stuff if you can't quite make it on your own. And I look for stories like this right now to keep my heart open. I can't afford the anger and even despair that I feel when I see such horrendous things going on. And this was such a good story. This is the antithesis of the Ayn Rand principles or goals or whatever. So,
Peggy, I'm really glad you picked up the phone. I'm really glad you did. Ted Gupp is nodding along here. Though it's interesting, Ted, it's in this 1933 culture, there was, and we heard it in these letters, there was a great resistance to asking for help.
Right.
People were very reluctant to do it, but they were pushed to that edge.
Right. It's one of the reasons my grandfather assumed anonymity was because of the taboo of reaching out. But I just want to point out, giving is still very much alive. A group of six musicians flew in to this gathering in Canton of the descendants of the letter writers, and they did not ask for a fee. And the day before they left from Salt Lake City for Canton, the composer in the group received a letter, and inside was a cashier's check and a note that said, "This is to help pay your way to Canton, Ohio, to play there. Please give my best to my grandson, Ted Gupp, signed Beaver Dot." And it was a cashier's check drawn on a Salt Lake City bank. We do not know who it was,
wow,
but giving remains alive.
How does this, I wonder in detail how this resonates today. Here's an interesting web comment from Ellen. She says, "The benefactors of the Depression could make a big difference with basic needs like shoes, apparently. Seems to me there's a difference in the kind of need that exists nowadays." I'm not saying perhaps she's on either. People don't need shoes, but she goes on to write, "If your house is about to go into default and its value is underwater, there may be $200,000 in mortgage payments going down the tube, you know, or say you have a health issue," she writes, "you know, does the benefactor want to pay your long-term care insurance while you go through a season of cancer treatment? You know, what about the, is there a difference in scale now? This is very inspiring personal philanthropy down at that $5 level that lifted a lot of spirits, bought shoes. But we've got, you know, another scale of issue that people confront today, maybe then as well.
Well, in 1933, they had the same scale. They were losing homes. Many of the families had to have their children leave home and were placed in orphanages and in neighbors' homes. Eviction notices were commonplace. This $5 did not turn the tide of the Great Depression, but the power of the gesture was very significant. And I believe today, even those who are facing the loss of a home understand and fully appreciate a neighbor reaching out to them. And I think that message is welcome today and always will be.
Let's go to Lindsay in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Lindsay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am just calling. I wanted to say that I almost don't feel like we're all in this together, and I think that was really interesting comment about the scale, and that's why I don't. I personally feel very blessed and very lucky. I'm unemployed right now, but my husband has a reasonably good job. We rent a home. We have a home over our head. We have two children. They're very healthy. And so we feel like we're lucky and we're blessed, and we don't have a lot that we need. We have everything we need, but there's very little we can do. And what we do through our church. We go to an Episcopalian church in Harrisonburg, and we have a food kitchen there. We have a pantry. We try to help out with people. We have English as a second language classes and citizenship classes. We try to help where we can, even when it's not that much. But the scale, I think, is a big issue. Sometimes it doesn't feel like it's that big of a deal.
Lindsay, I appreciate your call, and let me get one more. Matt in Charlotte, North Carolina. Matt, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, what do you know?
How are you guys doing?
Pretty well. What do you see, Matt?
Good. Yeah, I really appreciate this conversation. I figured I'd call in and share with you guys something I was able to do. I just graduated from Appalachian State University, and as a senior there, I was taking 19 hours of credit, which is about 7 classes, and then I was an insurance agent on top of it, and I was able to save up some money, and, you know, I was more fortunate, I guess. I was raised in a pretty well-off family, and I was fortunate enough, so I was able to donate a scholarship, and, you know, as a student to a student, I figured the idea was that students who go out on Friday night can save their beer money so that everybody can go out on Saturday night. And
it was a beer scholarship. That would lift spirits, I guess, Matt. That would lift spirits.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you can afford to go out on a Friday night, hey, why not save a couple bucks and help someone else's tuition so that everyone can go out on Saturday night and not have to work all the time.
And were your friends ready to jump in on that, Matt? Did you find them ready and willing to chip in?
Oh, no. My friends didn't quite jump in on that one.
Well, you were there. Maybe the beaver dot of your circle right there. Matt, I appreciate your call. Ted, what do you finally take away from this story about your grandfather, about that time, about this time?
Well, two things. I think we shouldn't confuse these difficult times with those hard times. These stories create a kind of no-wine zone because it's one thing to lose a portion of your 401k, even to face the loss of a home. It's another to see your children suffering from a disease and not be able to afford a doctor, not be able to afford to feed them. I think one of the messages is that we shouldn't be overwhelmed, that small things cumulatively really do add up. And the other thing is that hard times are cyclical. We got through it before. We will get through it again. I believe that.
Be ready to stand up in your own way. And to Ellen's point, we can look out together as well for the welfare of those around us. In hard times, in tough times, in these times, Ted Gupp's new book is A Secret Gift, How One Man's Kindness and a Trove of Letters Revealed the Hidden History of the Great Depression. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ted, thank you so much for being with us today. Great, great family story. We're really glad you pulled that thread until you had it all the way out there in the light. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll get an update on the billionaire's giving pledge. This is On Point. Last summer, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett launched a drive to get American billionaires to pledge at least half their wealth to philanthropy. They were first in line. The Giving Pledge, as it was called, has drawn promises of maybe $600 billion. Joining me now for an update is Stephanie Strom, reporter for The New York Times. She focuses on nonprofits and philanthropy. Stephanie, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you're writing about this call from Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. What exactly did they ask American billionaires to do?
Well, it wasn't just billionaires. It was people with substantial wealth, hundreds of millionaires, hundreds of dollars worth of woodwork as well. They asked them to sign a pledge promising to commit half of their net worth to philanthropy. They didn't specify much beyond that, and these folks signed a pledge, and many of them offered very moving statements, which can be seen on the website for the Giving Pledge, about why they were doing it and what they had been doing with their philanthropy.
Now, Gates and Buffett stepped up first. They're each worth, I don't know, what, 40, 50 more billion dollars? Did they pledge half of that to philanthropy?
Well, actually, I think Bill and Warren have both pledged far more than half of their net worth to philanthropy, pretty much what most of us would call the bulk, lots of zeros, billions and billions and billions. They weren't asking anyone else to follow that, just give us 50% is what they were saying.
What's the response been to this, Stephanie? Well, some have done it. You say they have moving letters at the Giving Pledge website, but I don't know. What percentage of people in that category are stepping up?
Well, you know, right now, so far, there are 40-ish people who've signed it. They have not added new signatures. Mr. Buffett told me not too long ago that they will be doing that, but they don't just want to add somebody every so often. These folks get together periodically in various cities in the U.S. and meet over usually a meal, probably lunch or dinner, to talk about what they're doing, share ideas, swap stories, and generally rub elbows.
Does the promise mean you give it right away? You give it when you die? How does it work?
There are no rules. This is one of the issues that people have wondered about with the pledge. There are no rules. It's just a promise to give it half of it away at some point. Many of the folks who signed the pledge had already made that commitment and have already, in fact, given away, in many cases, far more than half of their net worth.
So 40-some have stepped up. I'm trying to get a handle on what that means. You know, we've read a lot lately about inequality in income and wealth in this country. The richest 1% of Americans now take home about 24% of all the income in the country. That's way up. It was they took home just 9% in 1976. From 80 to 2005, more than 4/5 of all the increase in American incomes went to the richest 1% of Americans. So when you report that 40 people have stepped up to sign this pledge, do you have any sense what percentage that is of the folks that Buffett and Gates are calling on? Is that 1% of those people? Is it more or less?
I have no idea. They've never been specific about how many people they actually called. They went through their Rolodexes and tapped a lot of people, and one of the questions that came up almost immediately was all of us could think of many, many more wealthy people beyond the list that we were shown and say, well, were they contacted? And nobody would say yes and nobody would say no. Not all of them were contacted. They did not contact every member of that lucky 1% or even the lucky 0.2%, which is even vastly more, skews the income distribution even vastly more.
Mm-hmm.
They have gone about, they not surprisingly called the people they were closest to first. Mr. Buffett was very frank that not everybody wanted to sign it. There were various concerns. Not necessarily that they weren't giving their wealth away. Some people, for a variety of reasons, thought it was too public. They didn't want to be that public about it. Other people simply said, if I do that, everyone's going to be beating down my door asking for this money, and I don't want to deal with that. Other people had plans related to their children.
Plans like giving a lot of money to their children, I guess. What do you know about how Buffett and Gates feel about the response so far?
Well, both of them told me that they were very pleased with the response so far. There have been a lot of reports about billionaires in China and India who were reluctant to meet with them or talk to them because they didn't want to be strong-armed into signing this thing. Mr. Buffett told me under no circumstances do they intend to extend this internationally, that this is intended to be an American call to American wealthy people. and that it had been somewhat misconstrued as a call to get everybody internationally to sign on.
40 on that list right now. We know from the Forbes 400, and I think they're all at least worth $1 billion, that there are plenty more who could step up. We'll watch and see what happens there. Stephanie Strom, reporter with the New York Times, thanks very much for being with us, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.